I have two little tiny books here that are available still on the market. One we have in our bookstore in this paperback, The Living Word by Wingren, which covers this area of our conversation tonight, and another one by E. Gordon Rupp, which is a book of talks from the BBC on principalities and powers. The historical approach more to the meaning of the demonic in our time, and The Living Word being the proclamation approach to it from the point of view of the church and its involvement in what we have all had said for us in baptism and have said at our confirmation, I renounce the devil and all his works and all his ways. I was telling Doris this afternoon when we were discussing theology and how we present theology that one of the tests for any kind of theology is that it never ought to be the kind of thing that gives a child nightmares. It should always be something that leads to he gives his beloved sleep. And there's no way of approaching the demonic from the point of view of scare and the idea of using it as a kind of terror. There is an awe in this, and Mary has some quotes that she may bring down with her now when she comes from the idea of the holy, in which there's a very good quote on this kind of false awe of the unholy. But in Jesus Christ, there is a victory that is always present over the evil one. The only way in which we can live in the eschatological reality, or we're not in it, is in the knowledge of this kind of triumph, that he has nailed everything that was against us to the cross, and he's taken the principalities and powers captive and led them in his triumphal procession. That Jesus Christ is victor is the necessary presupposition for any discussion about Satan. The 70 return with joy, saying, even the demons are subject unto us in your name, Lord, in your name. And we're under the name of Jesus. It's A.D., the year of our Lord, 1970. And that means the demonic meaninglessness, timelessness, this chaos and abyss of man has been destroyed because Christ is risen. And there is a direction, a meaning for man. Man has become man and the Son of Man. And so Satan can no longer wreck his humanity and destroy him. This is the presupposition and the background for any possible Christian discussion. I have given you power over all the powers of the enemy. And this do not rejoice that the demons are subject to, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Only in this kind of an atmosphere is the discussion possible. And that means that in a real sense, the Christian is not confronted with the same kind of a feeling of frustration or terror or apprehension that the man who is a philosopher thinking of today's world and its history has, the premonitions of disaster, the knowledge of what has been, so that, like Hegel says, the only thing man learns from history is that he learns nothing from history. This kind of a human approach to our situation today certainly can lead us to this feeling of the demonic. And it is true that at this moment in our human history throughout the world, it's been much easier for people to believe in devils than it is to believe in angels, to believe in the devil than it is to believe in the Savior, to think that the world is somehow under demonic control rather than it's in the hands of him whose hands are broken for us and whoever lives to make intercession for us, so that he is the Lord of all. And this is the actual human situation today. I mentioned in starting our discussions this week about taking into the pulpit in March when we have this particular Sunday in Lent that deals with the demonic. And I had McCall's and Esquire in the pulpit with me both for March. And McCall's was on the demon cults, tarot cards, astrology, and so on in our time. And that was the big front for its top above its heading. And Esquire had pasted onto its front Satan worship in California. This is the time in which we live, that men can find a kind of perverse attraction in this. Leo, who left the village today, had himself a testimony to this effect, and we let him give it one night, even though I was apprehensive. And there were children who heard Leo didn't sleep. And after Halloween, Leo didn't sleep himself. He was an agnostic, believing nothing, and he believes the devil appeared to him. And the devil coming stronger than he is. He needed someone stronger than the devil, and that could only be Jesus Christ. And this threw him on Jesus Christ. Well, it's the kind of experience none of us would like to have. He sleeps with the light on. He had to sleep alone when he was here, and he has this kind of difficulty. That is something through which God would bring no man. It's something that Leo brought on himself by delving in this demonic and being involved with witchcraft and so on, as some of the youth are today. And then suddenly they fall into these things. And this is part of the hazards of playing with this whole area that some of our young adults are doing today. It can suddenly break forth on them in a rather fierce way. Just as we see in Acts where it was, Jesus I know and Paul I know, but who are you? Remember? And this demonic possessed person turned and beat this particular party. And this thing, it's nothing to fool with. But we as Christians discuss the shape of the demonic in our time, the shape of Satan in our time, under the cross, under the sign of victory over him, where he has been crushed. Under the name of Jesus, it means forgiveness. So Satan in that name falls from heaven. And this continually happens anew wherever Christ is preached and known. And this is our concern, that he is so proclaimed and preached that he does overwhelm the enemy in our lives and in our time. And that's concerning that we would like to talk about tonight. One of the pastors, when he left yesterday, who'd been here for about 10 days, and had ample opportunity that time to talk to me on several occasions, was saying how his life and his ministry come new through this particular stay at the village. And he's one of our abler younger men, a fine background. I've known him for most of his life. And he was just being about his pulpit and how tame it had seemed and insipid to him until this spring he felt he had to say what he believed and not say what others thought he ought to say. And then he recaptured his pulpit with a feeling of message. And he came up here for the kind of strength and support for any person that's living this way needs the support and strength of others. We can't go it alone. And in the fellowship here, he discovered that some of the embarrassment he's had for the very word Satan, some of the embarrassment he's felt for this aspect of the scriptural revelation is gone, because he says for the first time he sees that his battle is a battle with Satan, and he can go back with the knowledge that he has the kind of weapons to overwhelm him. And he's seen the shape of Satan in terms of the reality that confronts us, the boredom, the emptiness, the meaninglessness of our time, that is his primary shape, even in the scriptures, where the word for Satan and the satanic aspect of him is called by a Greek term that we sometimes translate futile way, sometimes we translate it subject to vanity, the whole creation subject to vanity. In Romans 8, it's the same word there. It means this emptiness. This you were redeemed from the futile ways of your fathers, from this emptiness, this meaningless, this boredom of life. This simply cannot be your way when you know the way. I have come that men might have life, have it more abundantly. I am the light of the world. He that follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. This means rescued from the domain of darkness into the light, the domain of light, from the power of Satan into the power of God in the forgiveness of sins. This is the reality of the scriptural proclamation. When Paul was called by the risen Christ, he was told this, and I will send you to the nations to rescue those who are under the captivity of Satan, to bring them into the kingdom of my love. And this is what happened for Jesus known. In the front of my particular New Testament that I bought for Holden Village, on the flyleaf, I simply wrote the little verse from 1 John in Greek that Jesus Christ was manifested to destroy the works of the devil. And this means that boredom is gone. It cannot hold its terrors and its captivity over us. The excitement of Jesus Christ is present, the Word made flesh, and this whole heresy and idolatry of a religiosity that's in one little narrow part of our life is gone. The whole of life is his. He's Lord of all, or he's not Lord at all. He's Lord of the sauna and Lord of the dance. He's Lord of the song and Lord of the play. Life is earnest. Life is real. We used to kid when one of the missionaries used to walk down the aisles of our prison camp, and we sometimes used to call him Life is Earnest, Life is Real Junkins, because this is just the way he got to walk and everything else. And he came from a particular group that tends to get this way, the Presbyterians. And they do. One of the fine retreat centers in America is run by them, and John Oliver Nelson, who's the head of it, has put $684,000 of his own money into it, Kirkridge, and it's having a rough go. And when we were there last year to visit it, John threw his arms around my neck, kissed me on both cheeks, and thanked what I was doing for the church. You would think we weren't known elsewhere. But he told me some years ago, when he was still at Yale teaching, before he left Yale to do this, and I said one time, well, maybe we Lutherans needed a little more of this Calvinist third use of the law and to set up this sort of a prod for us, because we seem to be so kind of lazy in some of these aspects of our time. And John said, oh, don't make your Lutherans into a bunch of heavenly bookkeepers. he says, this is what we Presbyterians had too much of. At least they got a sense of humor about themselves. Well, when you are in the grace of God and see that Jesus is victor, you do realize that this victory is going to overwhelm, that Christ is risen, the whole earth is his, and that our task is to claim it in his name, and now to claim every area in his name. It's been rather easy. Now, Jerry would just put this log in the fire, and as our fireman right now, it's been rather easy for us to see that he claims music in his name. You know, it's been a rather obvious thing for us in the Lutheran Church. First it's theology, and then it's music, isn't it, kind of for us, through our whole tradition. And Luther, of course, like one of the great writers of our time, Thomas Mann, says, I make no secret about it. I hate Martin Luther. But one thing we must all recognize, and that he's perhaps one of the greatest musical geniuses of all time. He was this, incidentally, in addition to some other things. Well, music has kind of gone with it. We realize that music belongs to God, but so do all the other arts. So does the whole realm of our human life. One of the greatest proclaimers of the gospel in our midst here is Laverne Reakey, a lawyer. And nobody uses law as well as he does to get the grace of God across. One thing you're aware of, after Laverne's had a couple of sessions, he loves to fight, he just loves arguments, so he gets involved. He's a lot like our Walt Bowman that way. But he gets you going, and he gets you mad enough to start retorting, get back and forth, and then he gets you where you see what he's always saying. We're always in error, but we're never in doubt. And as I tell him, that's just the opposite of the university ethos, the kind of thing that Satan really feasts on, where you're always in doubt, but never in error. So nothing happens but boredom. No action. And of course, you're never caught out. You're going to wait till everything is in before you declare yourself. And that isn't possible. And this is what kills university life, as we know. It makes academic life tedious. Well, just on the opposite side is where Vern's always found. And he says, that's why no judge in the state of Washington gets his check for December until his last decision is in. He's got to come in before he gets it. He's got to make up his mind. He says, the reason why you go to court is because nobody's right to begin with. You wouldn't need the court otherwise. You'd be able to settle it outside. So they got to decide between these two contests which one has the most justice in it. Well, this human situation of ours that confronts us continuously under Jesus Christ is one which he relates in a way that makes life significant, meaningful, because we're involved. Our hands are dirty with the sins of our brothers, and Satan can't get at us for it. We're where the action is, not trying to dress ourselves up beautiful for Christ's coming, like we were making fun of this morning, and one of you quoted, the doctor quoted this afternoon in Walt Bowman's deal. We are where Jesus is, and that's wherever there is suffering, torment, sin, ugliness, evil. That's where his people will be. They aren't out keeping themselves pretty and beautiful, singing songs in church. The whole of life belongs to him, and particularly wherever there's wretchedness and need and disease and poverty and injustice. And this is what where Satan is continually under attack, and he can't. We don't wait for his attack. We're attacking him. The gates of hell shall not prevail against you, because you're crowding him and you push him in. And Luther captures this marvelously in his whole proclamation, as he moves in on his own time. He's anything but a passive person against his society. He tells these rulers and these petty princes and so on, some of whom have taken over the monastic funds and so on, you give them up to poor relief and education or you're going to hell. And he gets it for the towns and the communes. So they start this. And Germany has a common school system 300 years before England gets it. And everybody has a right to an education. And to read just his comments on education, he's specific at this point. And he's very specific. You're not saved unless you're out there, you preachers, he says, demanding that every one of your people in your town has an equal right to these avenues of knowledge and understanding so they can use their own judgment. This claiming of the totality of life under the gospel is a natural one for us. And Satan would try to crowd us over, make us religious, put on special clothes, make us have a special voice for it, and he's once more taking over in society, the enemy of our joy. This he cannot do. And so we're involved. It's a conflict situation, and so there's excitement, there's venture, and there's uncertainty. There are lost battles. Well, Elmer Witt went after one of our dandy guys, the biggest giver to hold him, the Anthony Presbyterian layman, John Fanning, Paul Fanning was here all during July, and on this black issue. This was some years ago, and Elmer got through to him. Paul said, "You're right. I have no right to say this, that I'm not involved in this situation. I am." He went back where they were building a high-rise in Santa Monica with funds that this church he is hired by is not least involved with, and he was very much involved. He was chairman for the building committee, and he fought to make this an open housing situation. When he lost the battle, the poem he wrote was really a tremendous thing. I wish I would have had it published, because it was anything but self-pity. The fight was worth it. They'd lost this battle, but the war was going on. Just because he had lost this present situation, and this was still a closed housing unit, didn't mean that the impact of Jesus Christ and the meaning of justice and the rights of all would not come through, because we were joined to the human race, and he would conquer. This sense of meaning in your life, significance, venture, is where Jesus Christ breaks through for you. And it becomes exciting. And you see how this fellow takes off all of July, and he takes every July up here, just to be refreshed, renewed, and these resources return to him so he can live this kind of a life that's unselfconscious and delighted in being where the battle is. Not where you're sure of the victory. When Charles Malik talked to our youth convention that I've quoted here earlier this summer and gave us this tremendous little talk when we had this theme, Win for Christ, at the 10th anniversary of the United Nations, and I'd asked for our youth to bear witness to the nations and come out, and we had some 7,000 youth that I'd asked for there that hadn't bowed the knees to Baal, and he had the last session on Sunday afternoon, and he was saying, "God has put me to fight for the peace amongst the nations, a fight I know I'll lose, but that has to be fought, and has to be fought again and again. We have to fight for all the peace we can get, even though we know we lose." And that's where he's put me. But he says this is true in our own individual lives as well, where we only win with Christ when we know, though I stumble, he does not fall. And though we will, in our perverseness, be led to new wars, Christ shall still be the victor and will overwhelm. And the final word is his, because he is risen and the earth is his. This was the next president of the United Nations speaking. And this is our confidence. Minority that we may be in the earth yet, after all these years, that the powers of darkness cannot overcome this light. The light has appeared, manifested to every man, and therefore it must move on. As you heard this afternoon from Walt Bowman, and this idea of affirmation, this yes of God to you, the tremendous word of Paul at this point is that every promise of God is yes in Jesus Christ. And Paul was using an Old Testament when he said this. And just look at that Old Testament. That's the most earthy, materialistic book you can find. That means every man under his own fig tree. That means everybody getting a sabbatical, not just professors. Just check it out and see what it has in its affirmations of hope. It means they shall learn war no more. And we can't put limits on God as to when and where. In 1897, the old synod amongst the Norwegians, which had Luther College at Decorah, Iowa, and it had its synodical meeting in Minnesota, and in 1897 voted that slavery was okay. You know, nothing like Lutherans fighting the war some years after it's over. Senator Knut Nelson was a member of this Senate, a friend of our families, as it happens, and left his entire estate to the Lutheran Church. His younger sister had it till she died. It's now an old people's home in Alexandria, Minnesota. I was to collect his library. I was in prison camp at the time, so I missed out on it, but we got at least his children's chair. But he's one of our great heroes amongst us Norsk. He's one of our fine, great liberal leaders. He never went back inside a Lutheran church after that act. You can see why. Well, what we can't do with the scriptures, you know. But every promise of God is yes in Jesus Christ.
This is what Paul said.
And this is where Satan cannot limit our imagination, nor can he taunt us with our want of resources. How many, what did he say? How many stallions of the Pope? How many, what was it, does he have? Is it, it's not legions, you know, what do we call them in modern military parlance? Divisions, that was what he said. How many divisions does he have? That's what Stalin said about the Pope when the Pope was remonstrating with him for some justice for those peoples over there that they were overcoming. How many divisions does he have? But long after Stalin is dead and forgotten and Russia has a different form of government, there will still be the Church of Jesus Christ operating. This is when we had this big fight in San Francisco for control of some of the convention's facilities on, because I'd put our money down before the United Nations realized it was 10 years old. It came time for them to celebrate 10 years, and they were having a little time finding their quarters, and I volunteered to share everything we had because we wanted them there. That's why we were there. But it was kind of funny in the papers, you know, this whippersnapper leading a youth group and slowing up the United Nations. I said, I'm not leading a youth group. I represent the Church of Jesus Christ. And long after this United Nations has failed, and we've got something else, like the League of Nations before, now it's the United Nations, the Church of Jesus Christ will still be in the redemptive business. You know. Well, this is your confidence. The Church of Jesus Christ is there to do the work of God. Until I return, he says, carry on my business. And that Satan isn't going to shut us up. He's not going to be able to keep this gospel from opening up the possibilities for man that God has for us. Every promise of God is yes in Jesus Christ. And it's this that we confront when we open this. So that means that man is restored to his humanity and his possibilities. And this is what both of these little books are about, each in a different way. That which is truly human happens. Wherever Jesus comes, the demonic can no longer thwart it. Because it has to happen in you first. That sulking self-pity in you has to go. In the Gospel of John, there's a line directly from man's self-pity to the cross. That's why Jesus was crucified, John says. A man lying by a pool, 38 years, a long time in that case, and Jesus says, do you really want to get well? And he starts to whimper and whine about somebody else always makes it before him. He's got a good thing made. Everybody's feeling sorry for him. He eats for nothing. He's got notoriety, and there he lies. And Jesus says, take up your bed and walk. And they say, how come you're carrying your bed on the Sabbath day? And Jesus, and the man comes back. It's not my fault. Don't blame me. See, anything but rejoicing, you see. You told me to take up my bed. And then Jesus comes around, seeks him out. See here, you've been made well. Sin no more, lest something worse happen. And then the scripture says, and from that time, he went and told him it was Jesus, and from that time they sought to put Jesus to death. For that guy's self-pity. And believe you me, as I know men, and I know many of them now, thousands and thousands, and I thought before I got into a prison camp that maybe Dostoevsky was exaggerating us a little bit, but we're just that much sulky and self-pity. It's there. This is the sign of his presence. And there's only one who could say he has no part in me. And this is where he overwhelms with the knowledge of God and his forgiveness, and that God gives us himself in this forgiveness. I should have this tiny little book called Our Calling by Einar Billing, which brings this out so tremendously. So that in this finite person, the infinite makes his home, and through my finite life, his infinite will happens on the earth. That's what the Lutherans mean by the Lord's Supper. And that's why we refuse to retreat from that moment. God himself in this bread and this wine, his body and blood, filling me with himself so that his will is done on earth as it is in heaven, and his kingdom comes. Until it shall be a place where men need say, know the Lord no more, for the knowledge of God shall cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. As we point out again, the Lutheran Church and our earthiness, and this is our particular genius, that the scripture begins and ends on earth, with the Garden of Eden and with the new Jerusalem coming down to earth. And we try to stick to earth on these issues, and they do change. And Satan cannot keep us bound by our past. And so the first thing we have to say when we say in his strategy, how he thinks, how he tries to trip us up. We're not ignorant of the way he thinks, Paul says. His noemata, the mind process of Satan. The way his mind works, wiles, as one translation puts it. It's his thought process. How does he think, Paul says. He thinks that he can destroy your present bounds and knowledge of God and goodness of life by throwing your past up against you. And of whom was he speaking? A man who was guilty of incest. And he says, take him back in the church by a formal act of forgiveness. Don't let this fellow stay out there, broken and destroyed because you have excommunicated him now. Take him back in. He's repentant, and there's a new beginning. When I was in a prison a year ago in Wisconsin, preaching over Pentecost weekend, we practically preached continuously, day and night, from Friday through Sunday. It was simply an unbelievable experience. I began with these men by simply saying, God has sent me here to say to you, you are men without a past. You've only got a future. Because no man of God can stand in front of you and your past remain. That's what it means when a man of God is in front of you. Your past has disappeared and your future has come. And that's just what it means, because I am a word of forgiveness, a message of a new beginning, the voice of God saying, let yourself in on this. God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. Let yourself in on it. He who knew no sin was made your sin, that you might have his righteousness before God. Let yourself in on it. Now is the appointed hour. Today, when you hear his voice, harden not your heart. So we're co-workers with him, Paul goes on to say. And then he has that tremendous passage. Possessing nothing, we own the world. Penniless, we own the world. Poor, we make many rich. Knocked down, we're never out. We bounce back, he says. One of the great perorations of all literature. And Paul isn't talking about a future. He's talking about now. So Satan does not have this hold over us, that he can shackle us in this boredom or in this sense of groaning in our sins and letting our past overwhelm our present. Because we are men of the future, shaped by God, who is our future. And God is our future. And so Satan doesn't have this, brother. It's the use of the time where he has his big handle over you. And here's one place, like I told these guys, and they buzzed this out for a while. Here's a place where God is superior to you and where only God can do it. He can forget, but you can't. That's one thing you can do, God can't do. You can remember your past, and he can't. Your sins I will remember no more. Right? And when this gets through to you, the satanic powers no longer have hold over you. See, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Rejoice, your names are written in heaven. The fellow next to me that next night had killed a cop in Kenosha. Later on that same evening, one of the men who finally says, I want to be baptized tomorrow. I've never been baptized. He couldn't read or write. 14 of the last 15 years he'd spent in Wisconsin penal institutions, he's only 25 years old. He couldn't read. And as he came up to the cross, and I had him put up a cross, and I said, nail on, write down a piece of paper, everything against you, we're going to burn the cross as we go to communion. And all those guys around there, and these fellows had just come out of the lake where he baptized them, and he says, for one, fellows, it doesn't matter that I can't write. See, look, as I'm nailing it on, nothing on it. I just came out of baptism. And these fellows sighed, beautiful. But they were there with ears to hear, see? They were Lutherans and Catholics and Presbyterians and other guys who had nothing. But they had an ear to hear. They were hungry and they were being fed. And after communion, they embraced each other, not because I told them to like we do here. They just did. And they were going around and they said, you know, I don't have long enough left in prison for all the Lord wants me to do. That a future, you see. Now, this is where the power of Satan is overwhelmed, right at this point. And that's why the scriptures always show the power of the Holy Spirit falling on men in the forgiveness of sin. There's a new beginning. And then you can't feel sorry for yourself. How can you feel sorry for yourself when you own everything? See? Prison camps, guys used to come up and get so mad at this quality. That just, why were we like this? And they used to call it Lutheran laughter, you know, and kind of their sneers. But this... this fact that we were so cocky when we were prisoners. Well, as I told one of them, we got centuries of good living behind us, and that's true. We can never forget that. Generations who've lived in this gospel have been disciplined by it, who've given us this kind of energies of life. But at the same time, wherever we are in whatever place, we could do as we were saying there. O death, I do not fear thee, though dark thy terrors be, is that it, Mary? Though dark thy portals be, thy sting is gone, and near me the open heaven I see. That's one of them we used to sing at sunset. Another one, God's Son has made me free, yes, free from Satan's tyranny, from sin, from death, from fear of hell. God's Son has made me free, yes, free, yes, free. We'd sing these songs at night as we'd close the day. They were ours. Nobody could take us prisoner. Because all things were ours, we were heirs of God, co-heirs with Christ. If so be we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. And the sufferings of this present time aren't worth comparing to the glory that shall be revealed. So Satan can't hold that over you. You can't fall back into those old shackles of self-pity and timidity and inferiority complex. You're kings. You own the earth. All things that are mine are yours, because all that the Father has are mine. And Jesus says, and I give them unto you. He says, all I've heard of the Father I've made known unto you. All of you. And so this knowledge of God as Father, who will not let us see corruption, that he that lives and believes in me shall never die. So the last enemy, death, and Satan is the prince of death even, is conquered in that cross of Christ and that open tomb. And this is where we put our eyes and our faith, isn't it? And that's where we find our glow and our renewal. And that's why we can never, never, ever reflect on this enough or let it lay hold of us enough. I should read some of these others. Mary's behind me. I'll let you share on it. But I just wanted to say that we can't approach this verse without seeing this. I got a little letter today, and we cannot make out of the devil something with which we can terrorize anybody, because he can terrify no one who's in the cross of Christ and baptized into him and put him on. One of the delightful little books that I haven't been able to get a hold of, it's been translated in English by one of the fine New Testament scholars, O'Reilly, is just these disobedient spirits in baptism, and how baptism crowds the demonic out of our life, floods us with the love of God. So there's no room, there's no empty space for seven more wicked than himself, to come back and fill. Mary, go ahead. Do you have something you want to add here? I didn't notice you'd come behind. I get going here, you know. But it's just like in this, you notice the last thing, for instance, in this little book on history, an optimism of grace. He begins with the failure of nerve of our time. And that's the first chapter. And this is where this demonic finds hold, this failure of nerve that's in our society. And the church cannot share this. Even though we are bound together in a common fate and destiny, we know that Christ has conquered sin and death and principalities and powers. This confidence of the early church remains ours till this hour. And wherever we are found, this is ours. He speaks about Lilia and his prison cell, going and looking out in the midst of the blackout at the stars above.
So he uses that particularly in connection with astrology.
Well, yeah, here he has, for instance, the death of Martin Bucer. Those who believed in astrologers came over to tell him as he was dying, it's a terrible time to die. The stars are in a dangerous conjunction and so on. And Boots are dying, lift himself up. And he says, it is he that ordereth all things in heaven and earth. So shut up these people who believed in the stars around him. And then he goes on to speak about Hans Lilia in that same way. But I love one of his words. It's just before this, and I've oftentimes quoted it. Because here's where we Christians find our community, isn't it? In forgiveness. And that means we're sinners who need it. We can make sense of that part of our history of which we are victims only if you recognize that other part of which we are villains. Until we see ourselves as responsible parts of this society that is bent on its self-destruction. And this self-destruction has its seeds in ourselves. Then it's that we become human and need forgiveness. I think the best definition of war I ever saw was when I saw one way back in college, that war is the, didn't say overbearing, it could have said that about me, but it said war is the aggressive instincts, hostile instincts of, and then you write your name, written large and organized. And it's a good definition. It begins in us, doesn't it? And this is where we have this kind of sense of pity and sharing the pathos of our times. and how easy it is, this violence of our system, to overflow. When we begin there, then we have a kind of hold upon ourselves and allow forgiveness to meet our own inner needs, so we can relate to one another with room for each other. Well, in the history of God's people, he just speaks about how this has come to pass, how this forgiveness that overcomes man's hostility enters into history, how it allows the men of the cross to be men of the King in relating to their world around them. What happens in this human situation as they move with this confidence of the promises of God? And here he's got just a couple things from history. As a historian, he speaks from Lecky, one of the great historians. The success of any opinion depended less on the force of the arguments or upon the ability of its advocates than on the predisposition of society to receive them. In other words, you create a climate of opinion through the church finally until it's ready. And I think the time is at hand and the readiness to hear it in our society on this matter that war is a final agency of decision between nations. Is outmoded. Mightier than an army is the power of an idea whose time has come. Providence is on the side not of the biggest battalions but of the strongest conviction.
Networks on both
sides. Yes. And this sense of morale and your confidence. This cry of the saints, how long, O Lord? The cry of the saints in every generation. And that cry, how long, leads them into the issues of their society. And then Luther says, of these powers that are against us, that seem so demonic. This is a wonderful little phrase from Luther that he quotes. So says Luther, they puff themselves up in their power alone, and when the bubble is full blown and everybody supposes them to have won, then God pricks the bubble and it is all over.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that wonderful just in terms of our 20th century? God pricks the bubble, and it's all over. Yes, go ahead, Mary.
Well, I was thinking in terms of that, the idea of providence, and also with the idea of the quote from Luther, that when we came back from, we went to Germany during the first year of the war. First year of the war, because we were caught in Norway at the time that the Nazis invaded. And we had such a feeling of the united front that the Germans had, and the sense of real, excitement and we felt a country kind of getting won over to a cause. And even if it was diabolical, you really got a thrill out of it. Now that's a kind of a nasty confession to make, but it's true. I mean, you had a feeling that you had something that was really, of course, we didn't know at that time. We heard nothing about some of the things that were happening. We didn't do that until we got back in the States. But mad as we were, as Norwegians, at the fact that the Nazis had invaded Norway and taken over, still, when you got there, you were almost carried away by this kind of, sense of a spirit. Now, it was an evil spirit, but you could still be, you could be carried away by it. And when we got away from it and began to see, we got home, and we saw the kind of lackadaisical attitude of the United States, and kind of, it really bothered us.
Well, it wasn't our world, it wasn't our war.
We just felt that we were unrelated, and not that we didn't feel like we wanted the United States to go into war, but the fact that we were so unaware of what was going on. I think one of the greatest differences between our student generation, not Cheryl, but he and every day we used to have little sessions about everything that was going on in the world. But most of us in college in my day did not discuss world affairs. We were not concerned about where the world was going. and how it was going to settle its problems. And I think we were more in the throes of the demonic at that time than we are now, although we have more shapes of it at this time. But it seems to me that we were more kind of casual about everything. And you know, when Satan has things his own way, then he doesn't have to react. I think this is what was going on in the 30s, after the Depression. We've gone through a lot, of course, in terms of financial, deprivation. But at the same time, this hadn't taught, at least it hadn't taught a lot of us, maybe taught some, but it hadn't taught a lot of us to really see the world as in need, and to realize that our training in college, for instance, was to make us actually servants of that world in order to make it a better place, in order to try to figure out ways to work out some kind of possibility for peace, some kind of possibility for social improvement. And certainly we were not involved in any kind of civil rights concerns. I was only worried about South Africa. It didn't even bother me that the whole southern half of the United States was living,
Well, I can remember, though, when you were in college, the girls wouldn't wear stockings that had anything to do with Japan and so on.
Japan was at war, actually. We wore cotton stockings all the time.
So it's nothing new. And I remember how some parents were a little disgusted because on Thanksgiving Day, their kids would only eat soup. So they sent it out. So it was a youth generation then too much similar. But we didn't have the kind of organized press that they have today to get, I think, something through. I like this rest of this. I'm just going to read this, Mary, just a little bit in this evil thing. The rest right after he quotes Luther, and he goes on with Luther here because it's sort of fun. And I think this, we have to realize it's true. The pricking of the bubble is something which may work out through the normal process of history, say through the intervention of some superior military power, but is also due to the fact that such systems carry within themselves a seed of their own downfall, since they are founded on things which in the end are rotten and corrupt. Remember that they finally came to believe their own lies? This happened to them. The hideous strength again, too. In the end, Luther put it, they break down with their own weight. They are like a painted face on a balloon. As the balloon swells, the face becomes more and more terrifying. And if we take it at this face value, we can be terrified. But in fact, it is hollow within. And then Luther quotes from the Psalms, I have seen the wicked highly exalted and lifted up like the cedars of Lebanon, and I passed by, and lo, he was not. And I sought him, and his place was not found. How are they brought into desolation as in a moment? They are utterly consumed with terrors as a dream when one awakes. So, Lord, when thou awakest, thou shalt despise their image. And he says, history is full of the fall of men of pride and violence. He says, evil may have its own strength, but for all that, there is a quality of sham about it. Christ upon his cross has exposed it for what it is, and we Christians can be paralyzed by it only if we are deluded enough to accept it at its face value. I need not remind you how thoroughly John Bunyan knew this, how again and again his pilgrims are confronted by some menace, frightening and intimidating, which proves to be powerless when Christian confronts it boldly. The grim fortress of the Bastille dominated the city of Paris for centuries and became a symbol of despotism and injustice. At last it was attacked by desperate men, and it is said that they found it to be a great sham, that its guards were old and feeble, and that it had neither the equipment nor the provisions to withstand a siege. It might have fallen long before had anybody dared to defy it. He goes on here with this whole history of our own century. And then it says how this corrupts, the sense of externality that corrupts, he even quotes, and I put Temple here because I think he's referring to Archbishop Temple, who said of a recent Archbishop of the Church of England, they might have been a Francis of Assisi, but he chose to be Cardinal Wolsey. This feeling of abusing power, finally, and it destroys something of the finest within. The trouble is that so often Christians rely too easily on these things and in the end rely too much upon them and they destroy us. But we in approaching, I remember one thing in college it taught me about this whole business of mob rule. and it's carried me in the collapse of two societies where I've been there where war has come. You confront directly the leaders in this, and you can intimidate them. I happened to be setting tables when the sophomores came up with some of the upperclassmen to beat up the freshmen because we burned our caps. And so I came out for our setting tables, and they were going from room to room to rag them out. And I just went over to them, and I said, okay, you can beat me, but I insist if you do, it has to be so-and-so's with them. We have to be chairman of the student council. Look, finally, he said, what are you letting him talk you out of? Some of the guys said, for him, he's got to be him. He has to beat me. Then it's an official act, and I can get at him for it, you know. Well, what finally happened is that in the whole argument, they were broken up, and the mob rule no longer existed. They got, you know, into this argument, and it was over. But just simply to confront evil and to overcome. Remember in prison camp, we had graft in the first few weeks, and people said, shut up about it. Don't make any trouble. It's not hard enough to be a missionary here anyway without doing anything. But another missionary and myself decided that if we kept quiet about evil, it could only increase. And so we did make an issue, and we got rid of the graft. At the end, our cooks were scrawny and skinny as all. Our doctors were as sick as the rest of us. It was a group that had suffered together and got through together. The other prison camps where they allowed graft to go on under this feeling, well, you've got to be human and let it go. Many perished because of the results of their starvation, and others looked just like you and I do today. This is the issue, isn't it? You let it happen to you. And that's why Barth said so well to the theologians of Germany when they sit around and whining about the demonic that had taken over in Hitler and so on. And finally Barth just got fed up. And he says, all this talk about demons. This was 1945 after the war in Germany at a conference. All this talk about demons. He says, I'm sick of it. He says, why don't we just admit that we're politically stupid? You see? That they didn't get mad and do something about it. You see? And then we get what we deserve. And this, in the Christian sense, is part of the righteous wrath of a Christian against all this that works for injustice and wrong to the other. No services should have been held in any Christian church when the first synagogues were violated. When that Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 1933 resigned, a Roman Catholic layman, because law no longer existed if it simply was ad hoc law. That is, the henceforth law was to be what Hitler determined it to be. And he, as a Christian, had to resign. If then the teachers and jurists of Germany had resigned together, because it was a clear moment, Hitler would have been impossible. He could not have continued. Now, it's easier to do that when it's a foreign power, and that's why the Norwegians take no credit for what they did. It was easier to do it over against an invader who'd taken over your country when they did do it. And 92% of the clergy on the same Sunday resigned their jobs, their pensions, and their salaries, but not their churches, nor their calling as pastors. And the issue was not because they were not allowed to preach the gospel. As long as they stayed inside of the religious edifice and it was a religious service, they were all right. But the enemy, not simply the Nazis here, but the enemy of our joy, Satan, was corrupting the society, turning children into spies on their parents and their school teachers. The classroom no longer was a place where truth could be declared according to the conviction of the teacher. And this was point one on why they resigned, for the school teachers. And youth were being coerced into labor battalions and were being sent into other countries to work. This was an issue as far as the clergy was concerned, 92%, without being able to know how many others were doing it, without even being permitted to confer together, but having received letters from their bishops that their bishops felt this had to be the decision of all who believed in Jesus Christ at this hour, 92% followed. And as a result, the whole rest of the story became different in that land, didn't it?
And in Denmark.
Denmark the same way. Under, again, interesting enough, from the pulpit, Kai Munk and his people who were with him.
Well, not only that, but Kai Munk used this exodus of the Norwegian pastor as a kind of a shame to his brother pastors in Denmark who had allowed the occupation to take over. And Kai Munk wrote a letter at Pentecost, and he was a pastor down in the southern province in Denmark. And you think of what little countries these are, and how, you know, there's no place to hide in Denmark. I mean, Norwegians, after all, could run to Sweden, and they could also, well, some of the Danes too, but it was easier. They didn't have to go by boat anyway. And they did have mountains and places to, you know, take cover. But Denmark is just, you know, flat and beautiful and rolling, and there aren't any places to hide. And I, you know, you don't get so judgmental about people when you see their country and you realize they don't have much chance. But Simon still felt that his pastors were yellow. And so he wrote to them and said that they must start standing up for the underground movement, which was going on very vigorously at the time, and that they must preach out and be, you know, strong in their call for a free spirit. And this meant that he was from that time on a marked man who was killed, he was shot by the Nazis in a ditch on his way to church. But the fact that one group of people does something, this gives courage to somebody else. And I don't think we realize in the fight against evil and the demonic what it means when one person says no or yes in a decisive situation, what that means for somebody else. You have no idea what your actions are going to mean to someone else who is aware of what you're doing.
And I think where you see this tremendousness of that particular tension was that the temptation to be a cozy Christian, they saw as the great weapon of Satan. Settle for the fact that by keeping your mouth shut and not getting involved, and we'll make it through, and have our little coffee party still, and not worry about what's happening in our country. But as Kai Munk says, they're robbing us of our soul. As Bonhoeffer says, can we be less men than pagan men of noble ideal when we belong to Jesus Christ? And so these acts happened that, in a sense, were symbolic acts, not always effective. And yet, how effective were they? Well, as I mentioned, I hope to have the man who headed the underground in Norway over here next year with us, a simply great spirit. His lumber trucks brought out 73,000 German soldiers during the war to Sweden. 73,000 German soldiers were unable to escape from the power of Hitler. That's no small number. And all in twos and threes and four.
And he was put into concentration camps.
Well, he's been shot through both cheeks under torture. And there, just a very, very wonderful, very easy, and very kind of reticent sort of a fellow, really. Last guy to talk about himself. But this is what they were able to do. But the sense of one encourage another is such a tremendous thing. One of the things, for instance, that encouraged these people, not least, is that on the financial side of the picture, you were there. The Swedes were continually distributing money over the border that was coming from America all during this time. It fed all their Jews in their homes and cellars and attics. That's how they got hold of extra food for them and could pay black market prices. And you were there. That was a part of your contribution from this part of it. And the knowledge that you would finally come kept their hope alive. And it took a stronger ally from the outside. And I think all of us who aren't Christians, who are in this contest with Satan, are committed to the fact that ultimately, finally, it's going to take the return of Jesus Christ, short of his coming. And that's why there is this cry, come quickly. But we are not dictating in any kind of a blueprint about that coming and its time, its nature. He himself has warned us against this. And short of his coming, that which can be achieved remains still to be seen. Certainly slavery still exists on this earth when a whole peoples are slaves and you have slave camps and battalions right now in Siberia, but it's a different shape. Or when you had men in our grape orchards under impossible wages, another kind of slavery. But again, there are openness to change, and change happens. We were celebrating in our service Sunday night this fact that at least some kind of more equitable wage was a possibility in our own kind of slavery. The way in which torture takes place can take place in a home with a man and his wife, or between parents and their children. It doesn't drop out simply because there's no Belsen or no Buchenwald, but it has to happen from within out. But at the same time, as we are in this involvement with the powers of hell, we have this confidence that every time a little match is lit, there is light in the darkness. And that's our meaning with the village, and this kind of open discussion, and this kind of conflict situation that we can have so easily here, where we can go out and give each other a rub down in the sauna after we've had some pretty warm words. This relationship of person to person in our society that lets life be exciting and real again, so that the boredom cannot overwhelm and lead us to new wars, and new tyrannies, and new tortures, because it all comes out of the abyss of boredom, the emptiness and meaninglessness, the ultimate loneliness and forsakenness of men without God and without hope. And there's where Christ is the conqueror and the victor.
Mm-hmm. This faith and confidence does not come as easily for all people as it does for some.
This is right.
And is this a conflict or a presence of
I know.
Out in the front lines, we
they don't.
Encounter much more of doubt, of weakness, and of the struggle that's going on.
Yeah.
I don't mean that you don't.
No, that's just right. No, that's right.
Instances here too, but I think
that's right.
We don't have the same kind of a strengthening of each other.
Well, the way this happens, I think, is universally acknowledged by all, whether it's this little book, Meditations of a Believer, by a French science journalist, or whether it's this lovely book by UNESCO on marriage called The Art of Marriage by Beauvais. They all come to the same point of reference to this question, and that's the promises of God. Beauvais closes, in fact, with Luther in this little book that UNESCO had published, and he's speaking in this last chapter of in what sense is marriage a sacrament for all, and that behold, I make all things new is the promise over every marriage, over every home. And this is what he's speaking to our rural society today on this particular planet on which we dwell, that every home can be a threshold of heaven and have newness in it and excitement and wonder and mystery, because he says the all-important word is the second word, because that second word that we can't say this is my temperament or way that my mother brought me up or an unfortunate experience in my childhood, because he is greater who is the risen brother, and he does make all things new. But he says to lay hold of this risen brother, how do we do it? He says Luther in his time of temptation wrote on a piece of paper, baptizatu sum, clinging to the promise. These are Beauvais' words, word by word, from this little book, incidentally, not mine. Luther wrote on a piece of paper, baptizatu sum, I am baptized, clinging to the promise. So too we, he said, cling to his promise, that who is made two one and one flesh, and will not let man rend us asunder, and who discover this newness that he promises. But it is by living in his promise, isn't it? This is all the lay theology of our time finds its home and its accent here, interestingly enough. Tournier, another Geneva physician, this Beauvais is also a Geneva physician, with his guilt and grace, and how we are always creating this kind of demonic situation of guilt for each other. All of us do this. I do it with my intensity, unconsciously, to other people who don't have the same intensity. My coworkers don't take a vacation if I don't, you know, and they feel guilty if they take off an hour if I'm working. This is what we do to each other, don't we? And he tells this jolly story, really, and yet it's a tragic one, too, as we know from our own experience. He's taking his wife out for an anniversary, and this is an occasion to remember. It's going to be a memory to bless, you know. They're going to go out and have an evening. And she orders something. He says, that's only 5 francs. You know, creating guilt. And he says, but that's what I wanted. And he says, here he was, you know, you better spend it. Now's the time to celebrate, you know, trying to put it under the law. And this is what she wanted. He says, this is what we're always doing to each other. And we do this. And this is why we have to lift it continually for each other, too. This is the whole secret of our homes, isn't it? When I thanked Bjarni Harreide, and also, for example, for the tremendous children that he has, and he had the Lutheran World Federation's Commission on Parish Education. He's a layman and has charge of religious instruction schools of Norway. And he's just got such a delightful family. They've been over here and they've worked. He's one of our great friends over in Oslo. And I was thankful for his children, and he knows my family. He says, yeah, isn't it crazy, Carol, that you and I, who are such lousy Christians, have such great kids? And he says, and I know so many wonderful Christians, they have such lousy kids. And I said, well, Bjarne, it's very easy. I said, the answer to that one's simple. You and I have had to live in forgiveness all the time with them. Said, yeah, that's right. Well, this is right, isn't it? You open it up. They're not under the law of your personality. And they've got a right to their own life. And you have to live with them as brothers and sisters in the same baptism. No. And not kind of models of decorum and behavior. Of course, some of us, it's impossible for us to be that anyway, so we're not tempted. But it must be tough for people who can be that, I suppose. Right. But we open it up, don't we, for one another.
But don't you think, Carol, that I think what he's suggesting, too, is the fact that we don't have enough opportunity for encouragement of one another in our home communities. I mean, the old prayer meeting used to be that, but it certainly died out because of this rigidity and
became demonic.
Hypocrisy. And somehow every time there's been any kind of a break in the church, it's been an attempt, you know, through a group, through a community movement of some sort, to make honesty and love and warmth a kind of a common denominator for us all, and yet they become a formalism and a legalism of their own, and then they die out. But that seems to me as if the church should be able to, not necessarily within the church, but somehow it should be one of the ways in which we could implement something like this, so we could be of encouragement to one another instead of always being, beaten over the head by our own idealism and our own lack of fulfilling what we feel we should be doing.
Especially for this young adult generation day that you say is so turned off, and where this is so oftentimes true, they have a feeling, like I mentioned, who can stand to be a debtor? Well, you start off, and some of the parents have unfortunately given this impression. Boy, we really suffered for you. Now you got it all, you know. All you do is just come into it. We got it made. You just sit on it, you know. And nobody can take this. We all feel like we're not handing that delightful a situation. They've got to suffer with it and have something for their pains and aches, too, that they hand on to their next generation. But to let them share in this, to become part of it, where they're groaning with us and suffering with us in this whole common cause of a collapse of our society. This is, I think, part of bridging the generation gap. It's part of what I see a little symbol of this place. We've got a whole mess of exploitation around here that we're restoring, and it requires all of us, and it joins the Horty that 69 with the guys around here that are 19 and 20, and the same kind of a mission that relates to each other. And then you have the continual encouragements and any kind of a difficulty of these promises of God that are there. You live by them. As I say, without any piety, without any religiosity about it, it's simply literally true. This place lives from God's hand. And this is how we do in our homes. This is how we do with our wife and our husband. And when we take our life and our day from his hand, then I think we can live over this. But that doesn't mean that there aren't people that have unique kinds of affliction. We had a fellow here, for instance, the fellow who did all of this lovely benches over here, like Guthrie Theater, you know, putting on all that padding on and stuff. And Ed German came up here out of 7 nervous breakdowns. He'd continually been in depression. And when he got into this fellowship, because it's such as it is, it was 3 days and he was on his way out, you know, and healing, and it was simply astonishing to everybody in the work who's looking at it. Like some seminary students said, for the first time I knew I was at the seminary. But gee, for Ed, though, in this kind of community, you could lift him because it's that way, and you can't live with it without getting with it. And in normal circumstances, he sank down under his depression. Well, when he left this community, he left it to die, none of us knowing, because the problem for Fred all along was a bad heart. He died of a heart attack. When he got out, medically, it had never been seen. And with a bad heart goes depression, you know. This is one of the concomitances. Sometimes there are malformations physiologically that are a part of this mental depression and melancholy. So I continue to assert in this company this little line from a great poem, Hound of Heaven. Is my gloom, after all, shade of his hand outstretched caressingly? And I like to use these three-word prayers that come from a beautiful novel in our time by Elizabeth Gouge about mental melancholy and the disease of melancholy. One older priest in the Episcopalian church at a tea party realized that this young woman to whom he's talking had the same kinds of fits of depression to which he was subject. And he said he wanted to give to her these three-word prayers that he always prayed as he felt this melancholy come upon him. And that he put himself into God's hands until this melancholy was over. And these three little prayers were simply, into thy hand, thee we adore, Lord have mercy. And those are the little 9 words that he'd use. And just place that melancholy and depression in God's hands until the cheer would come back, you know. But isn't this right? I mean, we live from God's hands. We're all different. The kinds of temperament and that we may have is why I say when I prayed for the particular physical endowment for my own children, I asked for just one gift for them, and that was a merry spirit. But there are many who have been shaped by parents in such a way that it's difficult for this to be captured by joy. To make a law out of joy is the worst kind of law. There are those whose life may always be sort of on the edge of sadness and depression because of the kinds of experiences they've had. Sometimes I've discovered for women that's an experience of rape in early childhood or something I've been able to get through to and lift. Sometimes incest within a family. Sometimes other things of horror that they've never been able to bring to the top. I remember with one of my dearest friends, who was continually in this melancholy and so on, and suddenly one night, in the middle of the night, I said to him, about 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and he's one of the tremendous persons in our day, and he was then just a psychological cripple. And suddenly, I don't know, out of just God's goodness from somewhere, I just simply said, as a child, did the boys ever threaten to cut off your penis? And suddenly he just choked and started to cry. He said, yes. Well, this horror of this incident was what had been burdening him with all this other kind of crud to which he was. And I suddenly put all these things together. I thought, well, what basically is the most central important thing to a man? And this broke through for him. And that released him. Sometimes it can be some of these things that specifically need attention and help and where Satan can hang a guy up. And that's where we need to have these kinds of tenderness and openness to each other and allow them to talk and find where these hidden recesses are. I don't know. I presume maybe the doctors are right. I think I have a hand tremor. And there are often times in my life I wished I didn't. It's the first thing to which people are usually drawn attention to in me, and it's about the only thing they usually remember about me afterwards. So it's like that's something else. But in my own life, I really couldn't say what has caused it. The doctor, the Japanese get credit for it now since I was in prison camp, but I had fights about it when I was in second grade, I know, so it goes way back. And the doctors tell me it's because my mind works too fast for my body, and your physiological organism that can't hold your mental process, though I'm always sort of at the ready like this. That may be it. That's a nice way to say about it. It may be some other things that I don't even want to recall as a part of it. I kidded Herb Lottings one time about something else because he went in for hypnosis for a time. I said, well, Herb, why don't you hypnotize me and cure my ulcers? What, and have you die of cancer? Well, maybe some of these things are sort of safety jets for something worse again, too. You know.
I think this is right. I think a lot of your ailments, I've always figured that my asthma was an internal nervous breakdown.
Well, we have all these things, don't we? And this is where we are building each other up, holding one another in, aren't we? Carrying one another literally over the abysses. And this has been really, in the history of man, this has been the role of woman through the ages. And this role of woman has been destroyed in the 20th century. Strindberg saw this clearly. So did Edward Munch. So did some of the other prophetic spirits in the arts, that this role of woman had broken down. That was her desire for freedom, her feminine role no longer was functioning for man, and we had catastrophe only for us as a result, because man had depended for his very sanity on this redemptive role of woman. And you see this clearly, for instance, in Ibsen's Peer Gynt, when Peer Gynt is threatened by the Boyd, this mental illness that comes upon him, that's going to take him over, the sense of the demonic that's overthrowing him. And remember, from out of the midst of the Boyd, you heard that cry, "No, he is too powerful for us. There are women behind him." No, Solve and his mother still there praying. Boy, this is a deep insight into the meaning of woman for man, really. Every man, I think, is partially crazy and insane. I was so glad to hear a man say this in a wedding ceremony here in Seattle not so long ago, that every man has his crazy hours, and he does. And it's a woman that holds him together. He has his hours when he blasts himself, take himself through. And it's the woman's love and surrounding care and concern that somehow holds him in one piece. And this role is a real one in the sex relationship of male-female, I think. This is part of it. This need that we have of that. But this sense of cherishing each other over against the whole ordinances of existence and their quirks, and this whole feeling of this red that's there. And it's there. This is the human situation. This remarkable book of Kierkegaard's, this is the toughest one to read, The Concept of Dread, is one of the most perceptive things ever put up by man. That this is really our humanity. This is where we exist in a truly human sense when we have these kinds of anxieties, but that's where we also capture and carry one another.
I guess the thing that concerns me at this point, it's not an opposition, but rather, if you would describe the shape of the demonic, it seems that the people who need the help the most are the most possessed by this. And where do you find a relief for them?
Yeah.
They are the least able to find the relief
for themselves. That's
for
right.
For themselves, they are the most needful of them.
Yeah.
Where can we find that relief for them?
Well, this is where Jesus says, "I came not for the well, but for the sick." And certainly the church ought to be so constructed that it does this. The proclamation on Sunday ought to be such a casting out of demons. One of my prophets at the seminary put it in my day, and I thought it was pretty well done, that it's a good thing you fellows don't know how many demons are being cast out when you're preaching the gospel, or somebody would put up a sign, you know. But the healing that happens in this, the healing of touch, the caress of one another, the need of physical manifestation, a real thing, this business games people play, this little book that's been so popular all over America is based on how many strokes do you get, you know? And we all need this. It's basic to us. Happiness, a rub down and a sauna, as we say here. The church's relationship here and some of its services, we've never cast it out, but we are doing it more. But from my childhood, I could remember this kind of sense of release that you felt in a service with this laying on of hands, even when I wasn't part of it. As a boy, you could sense it in the atmosphere of a church. And we've restored it here at the village, and Wednesdays and Saturday nights we have this service, and some of the pastors tell me that all of them have this service. Now, one pastor tell me he has it just with his confirmation classes, this kind of a deal, and where the confirmation class and put their hands on his head and bless him as their pastor and give him courage to move on. And it's a tremendous thing, you know, between each other. And this sense of interdependence and need to honestly admit that it's there. We've had a concept of maleness and masculinity that's completely phony. It just isn't true. We all need this. And to admit this and to give it to one another. Then the power of this alienation that Satan brings in, that you're on your own, and you go in this kind of a fog and encased in yourself where you're nearly not communicating, can't happen. It breaks through because you're loved and you are cherished. And like Leo just went on, who's had his whole troubles with us, a fellow went out today that he couldn't get over. He wanted to leave the village about 3 weeks ago. I said, "You can't leave, Leo, we need you." And then, "You can't go right now." I was mad at him as he said it. Best thing I could have been. He's never been needed any place before. And the first time he ever felt wanted. Think what it did for Leo, just to know he was needed and wanted back on those dishes.
said, oh, I'll stay around. You mean I'm really wanted here? You mean I'm needed? I really am? You know, well, how much we need this together, don't we? And sometimes we forget. That's where even anger helps a little bit, doesn't it? One of the finest pastor in Europe in this 20th century, Barth quotes him several times. He's one of our Lutheran pastors in Essen. He came into a parish where he found three people on Sunday morning. Well, he could have stayed in that church paid by the government to three people the rest of his life, as some other pastors have done. But that's a kind of tough job, too. So he thought it was much better to just get these toughs in Essen out. And he brought them out to these sort of weekend camps. And he was out with a bunch of these toughs at one of them, getting nowheres with them. And he said to them, as one of them was shaving at the mirror, and he's talking to them, and they were still blasting, talking. He says, you dumbbells, you dumbercuffs, you know. He says, you don't understand a thing, he says. It's a good thing Almighty God loves you, he says, because I can't. And out he walks, you know, mad as hops, goes on the fall. And he says, here, he looked around, here was this guy shaving, with half of his face still shaving, came running after him. Pastor, you just mean what you just said about you being so stupid? Yes. No, about God loving me. He says, of course he does. But in saying it in anger, he says, he finally got the gospel through to these tough. Well, incidentally, that particular church has 3,000 young adults in it every Sunday morning today. Just one man's ministry in that dunginess of that Essen, Dieseldorf area. But this is a breakthrough of the gospel, you see.
But I think sometimes we're demon possessed by our own good temperament. I mean, there are plenty of us who get along so well, and I mean, I don't know how in the world I ever learned to know Jesus Christ, because I got along with everybody. I mean, I didn't ever feel sick. I didn't ever feel, you know, in need. It really, you know, was just nothing but the intervention of the Holy Spirit. And I think sometimes we think that only that being controlled by Satan, or being tempted by him, or caught by him, is always in, you know, is made visible in one kind of thing. Believe me, I think that sometimes it can be a terrible terrible trap to be genial.
I think that
the United States, our whole salesman approach to life in general, that you've got to be pleasant and you've got to be this and that, and we look at everything, that's the way it has to be. And so then if you are that way, then of course you must be a Christian too, because that's what Christians are. I don't think that's true. I mean, if you look at the place that Osborne wrote about Luther and how mad Luther's gotten, I thought, for goodness sake, if you read Luther a little bit, you'd realize, of course he probably had bowel trouble. Of course he had a lot of problems with his digestion. I mean, you can't write out of such, you know, real passion and not have problems. But we've got this blasted idea that,
well, everything is bland.
Meek and mild.
Everything
and
is bland.
Get along with everybody.
Luther is just great on this. Really, this is why he's so fascinating to read. He's still fun to read to this hour, because he's funny, he's ironical, and he's always earthy. But his name for this, whole kind of thing is Satan Saint. That's what he calls him. He says, and how Satan weeps when one of them falls into any open sin, should he become drunken or guilty of losing his temper. Satan is threatened with losing them. He says, they are his saints. He says, all these nice, decent people. And it's a really great passage, understanding about it. Because they never come alive. They just live on the surface. Well, fun for tonight, because he is the victor, and he does let us come through with this kind of exuberance of life that's called praise. And wherever there's music, the devil kicks. He doesn't allow music by the river Styx. So sing, you sinners.
Very bold. I don't know how many of you people, I'm sure, I don't know how many on this floor have read it, but I bet some on the balcony have read The Fellowship of the Ring. If Carol hadn't had such a long dissertation at the beginning, I wanted to just read one section.
Well, read a section. It's so much fun.
No, because I think if we ended on a good note, but I would suggest that you And those of you who haven't read it, especially those of you who are younger, you really ought to buy it and or get it out of our library. We have it here. And read it. It's long and requires a lot of, it's very imaginative. But I read it for the first time. All my family had read it, and they all thought I was really a reprobate because I hadn't read it yet. You know, Carol read it first, and then all six kids read it. Even Andy read it.
I read it and wrote poems to her in the margins so she could read them when I was in Europe, but she didn't read it.
I looked at that book. It didn't have any poems in it. But anyway, I read it this year after I broke my ankle, and I had to stay in bed, and I just thought, oh, I guess I better read that. I might as well capitulate. So I read it. And, it was during Lent, and I never had such a sense of I walk in danger all the way. I mean, the feeling of what all this great big fight is about between the demonic and Christ and his powers. And sometimes we have to have it put in some kind of a fictional or imaginative way in order to sort of get through to some of us.
You've got an end.
This really doesn't. It really doesn't. They're called, there are three of them, The Fellowship of the Ring by J.R. Tolkien.
You saw The Beatles' Help, that's a takeoff.
Oh, yeah, but
I mean, that's a far side.
Yes. Yes.
No, but really, the book is just fantastic. It's been the most popular book on the university campuses for these last 5-6 years.
This one comment.
There are kids who know it by heart. Now, for instance, these Nagel kids even know the Elfin language and write it, and they could draw you the maps. My son Paul could do the same thing. They've got regular international clubs that even meet and talk over this whole bit. But the conflict of evil and good has nowhere been put in our time in more dramatic form. With more delight.
Well,
and the optimism of grace all the way through.
But the thing is, there too is that it's the idea of a fellowship that you know, this one guy is fighting one battle all by himself. These aren't human beings; they're all something else. But I mean, they're all in these different areas, but they know that someplace somebody else is fighting and fighting against the same kind of evil. This doesn't put it in, you know, it's not in biblical terms, but. That's what makes it interesting for lots of people. They get snagged by it. They don't know they're reading a book that might have something more to it than this, you know, what meets the eye. Although Tolkien said it wasn't. He said it was.
He wrote it for fun.
I hardly recognize who I'm going out to
do. Well,
it's
a good book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.